The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Lads, do you enjoy getting traumatized on a weekly basis? Well, neither does my co-host Neil.
People call me a victim more than a co-host.
Anyway, welcome to the Mortal Musings podcast. I'm your host, Megan. Each week, we dive into some truly dark and disturbing cases. Do you ever find yourself listening to these horrific tales and saying to yourself,
huh? No.
Huh?
Well, the actual f***? Why? Why did he do that? Solved it, mate. There's no need for that. They're just acting the f***.
Our episodes include cases of serial killers, the story of a socialite that was held captive for 25 years, prison riots, wrongful executions, and scandals in the death industry. At the end of each episode, we throw in a tale of oddity. Anything from medical mishaps to the real-life Weekend at Bernie's or Mike the Headless Chicken. New episodes every Wednesday. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
And remember, here at the Mortal Musings podcast, we like to take the cases seriously, but not ourselves.
Hey friends, Nina here. Friendly reminder, this is part two in a two-part series. So if you haven't listened to part one, go back, start there, and we'll be ready for you. And now, on with the episode.
Jennifer vanished sometime in the overnight hours.
Right now, there is no trace.
Investigators say evidence leads them to believe that she's dead.
Stick my nose back in the trail. That's all I can do.
This is already gone.
Already gone.
Already gone.
After almost 2 years of legal battles and lengthy hearing delays, the trial finally began on January 16, 2019, at the Macomb County Circuit Court. Andrew appeared smartly dressed but emotionless as the opening statements began. Prosecutor William Cataldo presented his theory that Stephen McAfee was lured to the woods under the guise of purchasing marijuana. Stephen, who he describes as trusting and easily led, had no idea that he was traveling to his death. Cataldo explained to the jurors that Andrew had multiple motives to kill Stephen. He was incredibly jealous of his talent and the love that his family had for him. And, secondly, he had convinced himself that Stephen was sleeping with his girlfriend behind his back. Cataldo urges the jury to listen to the evidence presented throughout the case and to question whether Andrew's actions were really that of a devastated friend who made a mistake, or the actions of a cold-blooded killer. Defense attorney David Green then offered an alternative version of events. He claimed that both boys were vulnerable due to their diagnosis of autism, and Andrew's actions were not consistent with first-degree murder, but rather poor decision-making. He argued that Stephen was the one who initiated the meeting and wanted to explore the woods in search of Nancy's grave. He explained that Andrew had witnessed Stephen being violent in the past, and his behavior was unpredictable. That night, he carried the gun to protect himself, but never expected to use it. Finally, the defense attorney argues that Andrew had no choice but to shoot Stephen in self-defense, because Stephen attacked him unexpectedly, and that Andrew panicked and feared what would happen to him if he told the truth. As the first day of trial began, Susan McAfee took the stand. While questioned by the prosecution, she explained the family dynamics in the McAfee home and the relationship she shared with her son. At the time of his disappearance, his older brother Jonathan had already moved out, and daughter Catherine would stay between the family home and the home of her grandparents. Suzanne revealed that Stephen's behavior could be difficult, and he would push boundaries, but this was consistent with any other parent-teenager relationship. They noticed his behavior would get worse when he spent time with Andrew Fiacco, and this caused frequent arguments between Stephen and his parents. Suzanne described the last conversation she had with Stephen and how she'd tried everything to get in contact with him after his disappearance. She then shared the text exchange she had with Andrew Fiacco and how he had denied knowledge of Stephen's whereabouts. When asked about Nancy's grave, Suzanne claimed Stephen was terrified of the dark and would not even watch horror films. She felt Nancy's grave had been introduced by Andrew as an excuse for why they were in the woods. And remember, Nancy's grave is an urban legend about a burial site in the woods in North Macomb County. During cross-examination, defense attorney Christina Joseph began to argue that Stephen had attended a paranormal scare fest, owned a skull keychain, carried a pocket knife, and regularly rode his bike when it was dark outside. Suzanne confirmed that Stephen would ride his bike in the evenings, but would always avoid areas where he felt he could be in danger. Christina then asked if Stephen and Andrew had engaged in a sexual relationship, but before Suzanne could answer, the court quickly erupted with objections and heated arguments. After the jury was removed from the room, Judge Jennifer Fonts sustained the objection and asked the defense to avoid any further questions of this nature. Finally, Attorney Joseph accused Suzanne of receiving advice from an attorney and asked if she hoped to gain financially from the murder of her son. Visibly insulted, Suzanne explained that the attorney consulted was her brother and he'd been providing support to the family, and that she would never try to gain financially from her murdered child. Stephen's father, Michael, then took the stand, explaining to the jury that Stephen's skull keychain depicted Jack Skellington from The Nightmare Before Christmas, which was one of Stephen's favorite animated films. He denied ever hearing Stephen mention Nancy's grave and shared his wife's disbelief that Stephen would initiate a search in the woods during the early hours of the morning. As the trial continued, jurors heard from Deputy Mishakis, who filed Stephen's missing persons report, as well as from several officers who were involved in the search and recovery of Stephen's remains. On day 4 of the trial, the defense argued that several photographs taken during the recovery process should not be produced by the prosecutors due to the possibility of prejudicing the jury. Judge Fonts allowed 2 of the photos to remain, and these images were shown later that day. On Friday, January 25th, Detective Mark Morfino was introduced, and his testimony spanned several days. He detailed the investigation carried out by law enforcement and how he had exhausted all avenues of interest, but was unable to determine Stephen's whereabouts. Next, he explains learning of Cecilia's confession in April of 2017 and his decision to arrest Andrew Fiacco at the rehabilitation center soon after. When discussing the interview, he explained that Andrew would offer limited information to officers until prompted, or asked a different question, and his story would quickly evolve to fit his narrative. The jury then watched the 2-hour-long interview before court adjourned for the weekend. The trial resumed on Tuesday, January 29th, and Detective Morfino returned to the stand for cross-examination. Attorney Green accused him of coercing Andrew into giving information by pushing him for answers and insisting he would implicate his family if he didn't tell the truth. Green also asked why Detective Morfino repeatedly ignored Andrew's requests for an attorney. Detective Morfino denied these claims. He explained that Andrew had offered up information willingly. Andrew was made comfortable, offered a drink, and was read his rights prior to questioning. However, the defense produced several clips that disproved the detective's testimony, and this all happened before questioning came to an end. As the jury exited the courtroom, defense attorney Christina Joseph asked to raise an issue with the judge. She claimed that Suzanne McAfee could be heard saying, "liar," repeatedly while the interview tape was played, and believed that she should be removed from the court for the rest of the proceedings. Christina added that she believed jurors had witnessed this behavior from Suzanne, and Christina referred to the McAfee family as the peanut gallery in the back of the courtroom. Judge Fonts admitted she was unable to hear any comments, but issued a warning to Suzanne, asking her to remain silent throughout the rest of the proceedings. On day 8, medical examiner Dr. Daniel Spitz, and he is the son of Dr. Werner Spitz, if that name is familiar, Daniel Spitz gave evidence regarding the recovery of Stephen's remains and his conclusion following the autopsy examination. As jurors were shown images of Stephen's skull, Dr. Spitz explained how he had determined which of the visible defects were entrance or exit wounds before pointing those out to the jurors. He explained that both shots were fatal, but the shot to the back of Stephen's head would have resulted in an instant death. He claimed there was no evidence of a gunshot wound to the stomach, but explained that evidence of this shot could have been lost during the decomposition process. The prosecution then called for their final witness, Yvette McDonald. As she made her way to the stand, she looked timid and afraid, and spoke quietly while confirming her name. She began her testimony by explaining her relationship with Andrew, which she says began in February of 2014, when she was just 15 years old. The pair had been dating almost 2 years when she moved into his home. Yvette claimed that she had only met Stephen a handful of times when he was with Andrew, but she'd never spent any time alone with Stephen. Regardless, she claimed that Stephen was an ongoing issue between her and Andrew, as Andrew accused her of sleeping with Stephen during every disagreement. She said that at one point, Andrew drove her to the McAfee home and made her walk to the door with him. He then began questioning the McAfee family, asking if they'd ever seen Yvette or if she'd ever been in their house. She testified that in the hours before Stephen's disappearance, she was making plans to visit a friend in Florida, and this made Andrew jealous and annoyed. He again accused her of sleeping with Stephen, and the pair argued for hours. Yvette claims she eventually went to bed, but when she woke up around 2:30 a.m., Andrew wasn't home. She went to check the garage and saw that his car was gone, so she decided to go back to sleep. When she woke up at 9 a.m., Andrew was back, and she asked where he was during the night. He told her that he and Stephen had hung out at a gas station before he had dropped him off at home. She didn't think much of this conversation at the time, and a few days later, she left for Florida. She returned from Florida 2 weeks later and learned that Stephen had gone missing during the hours that he was with Andrew. She found this strange and began questioning Andrew, but he would quickly become annoyed, asking why she cared so much. Eventually, he asked her how she would feel if she learned Stephen was dead, and she told him she'd feel bad because it would be a sad thing. At that point, Andrew confessed that he'd shot Stephen 3 times in the back. When she asked him why he did this, he said he was part of a mafia gang and that Stephen had seen information he shouldn't have. She told Andrew that she didn't believe him, so he told her he would prove it. About 2 weeks later, Andrew asked Yvette to come with him for a drive. When she got in the car, she realized he was carrying a gun, which he began pointing at her. She claims he then drove to 34 Mile Road and directed her to walk ahead while he held a gun to her back. She realized they'd come across Stephen's remains when she spotted a pair of shoes lying on the ground. She said she could not look at Stephen's body due to the condition he was in, but Andrew forced her to look and told her that, quote, "everybody needs to see what a dead body looks like." Andrew then walked Yvette out of the woods with the gun to her back, and they returned home. She says that a few weeks later, Andrew forced her to go back to the area and told her she had to help him with moving Stephen's body, or there would be serious consequences for her family. Andrew had a duffel bag and an axe and brought the gun with him once again. As they arrived, Andrew began by removing Stephen's watch from his wrist and retrieved his vape and headphones. He then told Yvette that she had to be the one to separate Stephen's remains in half. Yvette said that she didn't want to do this, but Andrew threatened to shoot her. In fear for her life, she claimed she picked up the axe and swung it. Then she turned away and started to throw up. She said Andrew then took the axe from her and continued swinging. Then they placed Stephen's lower half in the duffel bag. Andrew also took Stephen's skull and had gathered a handful of other bones that would fit in the bag. When they returned to Andrew's home, he placed the bag into the trunk of Yvette's car. She says Andrew put it in her car because her license had been revoked for driving past curfew, so her car remained stationary inside of Andrew's garage for months. When Andrew drove Yvette back to the woods for a third time, she stayed in the car while Andrew made his way to the remains. He returned 15 or 20 minutes later, and they never went back to the wooded area again. Yvette told the jury that Andrew kept Stephen's possessions inside the bedroom, which made her uncomfortable. She said each night his watch would begin beeping at the same time, and Andrew commented that this signified the time that Stephen had died. According to Yvette, Stephen's body had remained in the trunk of her car for about 2 months, and there was a noticeable odor every time she entered the garage. As tensions grew between Yvette and Andrew, he asked her to gather her belongings and move out of the home. She said, "I'm not going anywhere with Stephen's body in the back of my car." She told Andrew to take care of it. So the two of them drove to Home Depot, where Yvette paid for a gallon bucket and some cement. Andrew asked her to assist with digging a hole in the back of the garden, but he took over halfway through and she went back inside the house. Once he was done digging the hole, he asked Yvette to help lift Stephen's body into the grave because he couldn't do it by himself. The two put on gloves, lifted Stephen into the ground, and then covered him with cement. Afterward, they burned the gloves in the bag they'd used to transport the remains. Yvette claimed she had no idea what he'd done with Stephen's skull as Andrew buried it on his own. Within a couple of weeks, Yvette left the Fiacco home and moved back in with her father. She asked Andrew not to contact her anymore, but he would continue to send her threatening text messages about staying quiet. She eventually confided this story in her friend Cecilia as she was becoming more and more afraid of Andrew and wanted to tell someone what he had done. During cross-examination, Yvette was asked why she didn't come clean to the police when she was brought in for questioning in September 2016. They implied that she had plenty of opportunity to tell the police what she knew, which would have eliminated any threat from Andrew. Yvette claimed that Andrew convinced her that the mafia would go after her family if he was ever arrested, and she no longer knew what to believe. She insisted that she was terrified of Andrew, and after seeing Stephen's body, she believed him capable of anything. The defense pointed out that Yvette was happy to stay with Andrew despite what he had done, as they had only broken up once Andrew had forced her to leave the home. She denied these claims. The defense began their case on February 1st, and they called upon Jeffrey Lazur, a longtime friend of Andrew Fiacco. Jeffrey testified that he met Stephen through Andrew, and the three would often hang out together. He claimed that Stephen would carry a knife with him everywhere he went, and made a point of bragging about it. He said he'd been on the receiving end of Stephen's temper and had witnessed moments where he would randomly snap. Jeffrey described an incident in 2015 where the three were hanging out in Jeffrey's basement, drinking alcohol and smoking pot. During a disagreement, Stephen punched a hole in the drywall and was asked to leave the home. Andrew's mother, Alicia Fiacco, also testified. She claimed she had adopted Andrew when he was 2 years old, and she was aware he had been diagnosed with autism and fetal alcohol syndrome. Alicia described the relationship between Yvette and Andrew and claimed Yvette was never invited to live in her home. When Alicia realized Yvette had moved in without permission in January of 2016, she was angry and told Yvette to leave. Yvette did leave for a few days, but climbed back into the house through Andrew's bedroom window. During the 9 months she was living there, Alicia had called Yvette's parents numerous times, asking them to come get their child, and had even reported the situation to Child Protective Services. Eventually, she felt like she had no choice but to let her stay. Alicia explained that Yvette did not have a job and would stay at their home while everyone else was working. She'd tried to help Yvette to find work, but said she could never hold a position for longer than a few weeks before leaving or being fired. She described Yvette as a liar, and Alicia began to grow tired of financially supporting her. In September of 2016, she told Andrew she'd had enough and made him pack her things. The defense then called their final witness, Dr. John Hunsaker, a licensed medical examiner with a specialty in forensic pathology. His testimony was given via video link. He confirmed Dr. Daniel Spitz's initial findings and agreed that both gunshot wounds would have been fatal. The defense asked him if the wounds may have caused involuntary movements after the shots were fired, and Dr. Hunsaker agreed. He also agreed that Andrew may have mistaken these movements for Stephen trying to get up off the ground. He concluded that the gunshot wound to Stephen's face likely occurred first, but claimed that firearm testing and clothing analysis would have given him a greater understanding of the timeline of events. Defense Attorney Green quickly retorted that the defense would have liked those items to be tested too, and an argument erupted in the courtroom. Green and Cataldo came face to face and began shouting at each other, before Judge Fonts demanded that they leave the courtroom. Unfortunately, this is just one example of several incidents between the two attorneys. Throughout the trial, it was evident that prior tension existed between them. They were regularly asked to behave professionally, but continued to speak to each other sarcastically and would shout over each other's objections. As Suzanne McAfee continued to share the footage each day in court, she included the hashtag, "It's about Stephen." Following this incident, the defense rested their case, and jurors were dismissed for the weekend. And we'll be right back after hearing from this week's...
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Sponsor. Just 4 days later, closing statements began, and William Cataldo made his way to the podium to deliver his final argument. He told the jury that when reaching their verdict, they should consider Andrew's actions instead of his words. He believed that the truth was demonstrated within the behavior Andrew carried out before picking Stephen up that evening, and the decisions he made after Stephen was dead. Andrew shot Stephen twice in the head at close range and left him to die in the dark on his own. He did not call 911 to get medical assistance. Instead, he started destroying evidence. He discarded Stephen's phone in a dumpster and lied to the police. Andrew then involved Yvette McDonald in the dismemberment of Stephen's remains, taking items from his body as souvenirs. He hid Stephen's skull in a block of cement and buried the remains in his own backyard. He never showed any remorse and continued to deny involvement at the time of his arrest. He only came clean when he knew he'd been caught. And then he took that opportunity to blame Stephen for his own murder. He ends his statement asking the jury to find Andrew Fiacco guilty of all charges. Then it was the defense's turn, and David Green instructed the jury to discount all of Andrew's actions after Stephen's death, as they were irrelevant when determining premeditation. Green argued that Andrew did what he believed was necessary to protect himself at the time, and then panicked when explaining his actions to the police. He also told the jury that there is no evidence to suggest that Andrew had suddenly decided to murder his closest friend. He painted Stephen as the aggressor, someone with limited self-control, and that Andrew was justified in his decision to carry a gun. He reminded the jury that Stephen was the one who asked Andrew to hang out that night, and he wasn't lured out of the house as prosecution had initially suggested. Instead, Andrew shot Stephen in self-defense following an argument and then panicked after witnessing the involuntary movements made by Stephen's body. As both statements concluded, Judge Fonts delivered instructions to the jury. She asked them to carefully consider all the evidence before reaching a decision, and in the face of doubt, they must find Andrew not guilty. It took only 2 days for the jury to reach a unanimous verdict. On Thursday, February 7, 2019, Andrew Fiacco was found guilty of the lesser charge of second-degree murder. The jurors also delivered guilty verdicts for felony firearm charges and mutilation of a body, as well as lying to police. All jurors stood to confirm they agreed with the verdict before being dismissed by the judge. Later that day, Yvette McDonald appeared in court to receive her sentence for her part in the crime. She pled guilty to 2 charges, accessory after the fact and mutilation of a body. As part of her plea deal, the charge of lying to police was dropped. For the first time, the McAfee family stood and read victim impact statements to the judge. Suzanne McAfee delivered a tearful statement, explaining how her heart was forever changed on the day Stephen disappeared. She detailed the 13 long months, hoping he was okay and praying for the return of her son. She argued that Yvette McDonald could have ended their suffering at any point, but she chose to protect a killer instead, knowing that Stephen's body was in the trunk of her car. The family believed that her testimony was self-serving, and Suzanne felt Yvette had willingly helped Andrew because she was infatuated with him. Suzanne then held up a photograph of Yvette taken after she posted bond. There's Yvette with her friends, holding up her leg with the ankle monitor attached. Suzanne reminded the court that it wasn't fair that Yvette was allowed to continue her life when Stephen couldn't continue his. Yvette was able to graduate high school and move to further education. She was able to spend time with family and friends. Suzanne believed the picture demonstrates the lack of remorse shown by Yvette from the start and asked the judge to consider this during sentencing. Yvette then took the opportunity to speak to the judge, and she said, quote, "I want to apologize for being cowardly and not coming forward with the information that I had. I will never understand the pain they're living through. I am so sorry for what happened to Stephen. If I could go back and try and maybe do something differently, I would. I would come forward sooner. I'm sorry they had false hope for all those months. I would take it back in a heartbeat if I could." As the hearing came to an end, Judge Fonts explained the multiple factors she considered when coming to her sentencing decision. She spoke of the seriousness of the crime and how Yvette's reluctance to come forward had contributed to 13 months of torment for Stephen's family. Because of this, she denies Yvette the opportunity to erase the convictions from her record, as requested by the attorney. The judge acknowledges that Yvette agreed to testify against Andrew, but adds that she still deserves to be incarcerated for her involvement in the crime. In conclusion, she sentenced Yvette to 1 year in prison with an additional 3 years of probation. On March 21, 2019, Stephen's family were in court again for the sentencing of Andrew Fiacco. Again, all members of the McAfee family took the stand to share the devastating impact of Andrew's actions. Michael McAfee opened his statement with a poignant quote from Shakespeare's Macbeth, "From the pricking of my thumbs, something wicked this way comes." He described Stephen as a kind, thoughtful, caring, and trusting child. He said Stephen trusted his friend and didn't think he would do him any harm. Michael goes on to share the numerous memories he has of Stephen and how he misses him, his creativity, the noise of the drums coming from the basement as he arrived home from work. In her statement, Suzanne also spoke of the disrespect that her family had endured throughout the trial. She said, quote, "During the trial, there was an attempt by defense to remove me from the courtroom after hearing my frustration surface verbally. My family had to suppress our feelings over this very long legal process. At times, We were victimized by the manner in which our friends and family in the courtroom were referred to as the peanut gallery. I would also like to say I in no way would ever try to benefit monetarily from the murder of my son. Your Honor, why were we, the family of Stephen, victimized by numerous distasteful actions by defense? Myself, along with my family, do not deserve any more pain and suffering. Stephen's siblings also shared their devastation after learning that their little brother had been murdered. Catherine spoke of how Andrew had stolen Stephen's future. She adds that Stephen will never be able to celebrate the milestones that her and Jonathan will have. He will never be able to attend their weddings or meet any future nieces or nephews, and she will never hear her children call him Uncle Stevie. Jonathan McAfee said, "I remember one time telling Andrew Fiacco to look out for Stephen because they seemed to be good friends, and I was away at school, unable to watch over Stephen on a daily basis. This is my biggest regret in life, trusting him. It is an absolute insult to the memory of my brother and myself to call Andrew Fiacco Stephen's best friend. Andrew Fiacco is a murderer of Stephen McAfee. I am Stephen's best friend." All four members of Stephen's family asked Judge Fonts to deliver the maximum possible sentence to Andrew Fiacco to alleviate their fears of him ever being released and harming another person. Before delivering her decision, the judge asked if Andrew would like to make a comment. He stood up and began to apologize to the McAfee family. He says that he felt their pain throughout their testimony and also missed Stephen very much. He claimed he did not show remorse throughout the trial because he was in court and had to keep a level demeanor. After thanking his parents and attorneys for their support, he returned to his seat. Judge Fonts then turned her attention to Andrew. She said he has destroyed the lives of Stephen's family, his own family, and later, Yvette McDonald's family. She commented on his lack of remorse, his inability to tell the truth, and questioned his ability to ever be rehabilitated. When considering discipline, protection of society, potential for reform, and deterrence, she believed that Andrew's sentence should exceed the recommended guidelines. Overall, she sentenced Andrew Fiacco to a minimum term of 50 years in prison. He was then escorted out of the room. Unfortunately, this wouldn't be the last time that Stephen's family had to worry about Andrew Fiacco. In 2020, his defense team filed an appeal, arguing that his two-hour interview should never have been introduced in court, as his requests for a lawyer were repeatedly ignored. They argued that a review of his sentence should have been carried out and his conviction should have been questioned as a result. In November of 2020, the Court of Appeal responded, agreeing that Andrew Fiacco had invoked his right to an attorney and that his Sixth Amendment right was violated when officers refused to provide legal counsel. However, they argued that the evidence presented at trial would still support overwhelming guilt, even if Andrew's statement was no longer considered. The appeal was denied. A second and final appeal was denied a year later by the Michigan Supreme Court, who agreed that Andrew Fiacco's conviction should be upheld. After 6 long years, the McAfee family were finally able to begin moving on, at least to move on without the fear of Andrew being released. According to the Michigan Department of Corrections, Yvette McDonald completed her sentence and was discharged from prison in 2022. Her current whereabouts are unknown. 26-year-old Andrew Fiacco remains incarcerated at the Lakeland Correctional Facility in Coldwater, Michigan. He will be eligible for parole in April of 2069. I'm Nina Instead, the producer and voice behind the Already Gone podcast. I appreciate you listening, and please be safe.
It's time to get down to business with $30 a month business internet. WOW Business offers 99.9% network reliability so that you can keep your business moving. $30 a month gets you 30 megabytes per second with 24/7 US-based support, a price lock guarantee, and a 60-day satisfaction guarantee. Lock in our lowest priced offer for the support you need. Go to switchtowellbusiness.com. Offer for new customers with a 2-year agreement subject to change. Prices do not include taxes, fees, and equipment charges. Restrictions apply.